Great. Thank you very much, Kevin. We didn't have a seat for Hal here, so I feel badly. Hal Saltzman is in the Department of Public, or Professor of Public Policy at Rutgers University. So please welcome Hal Saltzman, the seatless Hal Saltzman.
No such luck. I do want to first respond to something that happened in the other panel where aspersion was cast upon my fine country as a believer that the world only was created in 5,000 years, and said he also noted that, you know, we're the most powerful and wealthiest, and forgot to make the connection that we like to do things quickly and we don't let facts get in the way. And so we should take note of that. Anyway, this is forward. Kind of following up on Kevin's talk, I'm going to bring you a little more down in the weeds, so the detail of firm restructuring and some of the evolution and change, and also perhaps with a different perspective that, you know, at a top level, there's a certain ecology that may or may not show more or less change, but there's a certain dynamism of and things that do evolve and come back that is not always apparent by the aggregate. That happens more when you look at the detail. And, you know, kind of defining a decade, and particularly for in a number of realms, we've seen in the economy, but also I think in firms, the way we approach things, have an ideology, a belief system about markets. So, you know, started 20 years ago that markets were going to bring freedom and a lot of flexibility, and we're ending the 20 years with another kind of collapse and suggestion that maybe market approaches should be rethought. But nonetheless, it's driven, been a very strong driver, particularly in the U.S., of beliefs about how firms run. So I'm going to take you through two cases in two kinds of labor markets, internal labor markets, we call them, you know, kind of what happened internally structure, and then externally, and talk about some of the relationship between organizational structure, human capital, and HR practice. So in the 1990s, and I think Kevin hit on that, we saw a lot of discussion about the end of employability, the kind of really a turn in probably 100 years of one direction in corporate firm growth, of incorporation growth, stability, and expansion, to a reshuffling, rethinking about moving outside the corporation. And particularly for labor, it began a discussion of whether external markets can replace internal labor markets, that that you would have less rigidity if people just shopped on the market. You bought spot market. You started to buy rather than make for what you wanted. So we saw periods of downsizing, great shifts. Predictions, you have a 5-year career span. You have great flexibility and fluidity. People would be moving around. And the establishment of two-tier workforces, of a core workforce and then contract workforce, temporary workforce, outsourced workforce. And it was played out often in the idea of citizenship. In one interview, talking to a large firm, said, you know, what right does the person mowing the lawn or cleaning the toilets have to enjoy the benefits of our large firm with health benefits, pension benefits, things like that? That level of work just doesn't enjoy or the rights that we have in our high benefit structure, nor the cost. So we saw that, you know, kind of discussion kind of change and a buy versus make approach, I think, to skills. Now, some of the HR response in response to this was this idea of employability, that every worker a free agent, and that the guarantee then was incumbent upon individuals to acquire their skills as a way of security. Your own job security was to improve your own skills. And then it also became a requirement for hiring. And again, going back to this buy and make, rather than train, the idea that you would take in human capital and have a corporate responsibility to train, everybody was on their own to do those things and be employable. Now, the outcomes of this were one thing to kind of cut down what we call job lock, and I'll talk more about that later, but you know, the idea that you're on the labor market, you're no longer tied to this kind of firm. And one of the better firms thought, in this condition, the way we can do this and respond to this is a kind of genuine HR concern, because the realities of the economy require this very free flow of labor, was to help people improve their skills and be employable. And so it let any worker who wanted to kind of plan for their next five-year career could engage in any kind of training, education that they wanted to do. And people started taking them up and doing all sorts of things. And it was an insurance company. And interestingly, I don't know if maybe it's something about actuaries, but after 6 months, they found out their entire actuarial department was training to do something else. And they started to panic, realizing this employability wasn't quite playing out the way that they thought, that it released a lot of people to leave in an up market. So the lessons learned out of this, kind of another post-exuberance reckoning, was that skills, turnover, and the market play out in different kinds of ways than one might expect. That turnover, there was a reason why labor markets were internalized, to try and increase job attachment, not just for workers and security and kind of healthy workplaces in that way, but for a very strategic function to keep people bound to the firm that minimized training costs, turnover costs. You know, turnover is one of the kind of banes of existence there. So this worked out, and how this played out in one particular case of call centers. If you remember, call centers in the 90s started as glorified message-taking centers when they first started to emerge, and were looked that way as cost centers. So the idea, for example, in retail is there were nothing more than order takers, people calling with their orders, taking orders over the phone. It costs to be minimized, so you get a lot of monitoring, cost per call, timing per call. Customer complaints, you register the complaint, and transaction processors, you know, changing addresses in finance. And so to drive down costs, you know, this kind of a very disposable labor force, minimal skill approach was taken. That when people took orders, you just enter the order, get them off the phone. Complaints, you key them in, get them out of there. You know, try minimal time, and transaction processing in finance meant you address change, you just change it and let them go. Well, what happened is that these things started to evolve. Call centers started to move and have slightly different functions. That is, more of orders got placed over the phone, people started to realize these were their sales force. As complaints came in, they realized that not addressed, customers would leave. So, for example, in telephone companies, while they're busy haggling over a $5 or $10 erroneous change, you know, a charge on your phone bill, if you remember the old experiences with the phone company, the marketing department was out spending $75 to $100 for customer acquisition. And finally, somebody realized, you know, for the price of $5, we lose a customer and we have to walk out and spend another $100 to get a new customer. That the kind of lock, not just on job lock, but the customer lock was gone with more competition, more phone companies. You may notice there's a reason why you get a 1 and 2 year contract on your cell phone if you have that. And then transaction processing. What happened is, you know, and this was a bottom-up effort. People who were doing these address changes started talking to other people in the firm and said, well, you know, this person's changing their address because they're getting married. They're moving. That we have a chance here to sell them another product. That when they get married, there's two people. We can sell them another insurance policy. They want a different kind of insurance policy. So the front line became their best source of information and, in fact, revenue gain for that. And order takers you could upsell. So what you had to move was from order takers to sales associates to customer retention and do that. And that required a different kind of organization. And the lesson learned was you had to climb back up in rebuilding internal labor markets, providing skills. But as you can see, the drive down is a lot faster and a lot quicker than the climb back up. And that was slow and a real reconstruction of internal labor markets that had to occur and took a much longer process at great cost. And many of the firms that drove down the fastest and quickest learned painful lessons. Some of them didn't survive some of the lessons of the 90s downsizing and outsourcing. So I'll bring you to another external labor market today. If you don't want to read all the text, I can summarize it, which is that we're going to hell in a handbasket. And the reason is we don't have enough scientists and engineers to, you know, promote innovation. What I find interesting about this is the language that's used that actually makes what I said a bit of an understatement if you look at it, you know, that we're all in a race, whether you're a lion or a gazelle, the sun comes up, you better be running to get eaten. This is a statement of the famous report, at least in the States, called Rising Above the Gathering Storm, that drove a lot of legislation, came out of the National Academy of Sciences and became an America Competes bill, and is still, never funded, of course, but is still being discussed as the thing to get America back on track and rise and respond to the trade. And there are any number of companies coming up saying we have to get the workforce here to do that. So the policy response driven by this kind of talk has been a large, sustained effort to increase the graduate supply. We need more scientists and engineers. We've got to pump more people in the pipeline. Everybody's got to be interested in it. What happened to the days of the space race? Guest worker program, the U.S. equivalent called the H-1B visa program. We need to expand. We need to scour the world and bring the best and the brightest. And in a very interesting turn of events, I think, politically, is that any discussion of this as a labor market problem has become considered xenophobic, anti-immigrant, and very illiberal. And I find it curious, probably dating back a bit, which is brain drain used to be considered imperialism, but now seems to be the liberal ideal in the United States. And then finally is that we should do nothing to inhibit, if not facilitate, offshoring, because it is a global search, this flat earth society by its leader Tom Friedman and others, about, you know, we sailing off the end of the earth in a search for labor arbitrage. So what's the reality here? And here I'm going to follow Kevin's cue and look at some reality here in terms of numbers. Well, what has actually happened to the college supply? If you look at the proportion of kids who are interested in science and engineering, science and math performers, and go on through college and obtain these degrees, the percent has been more or less flat for over 30 years, essentially no change. And of course, with a growing population, means what we have are increasing numbers of graduates in science and engineering. So the supply, in fact, has gone up quite a bit in numbers. Now, how does that compare to the job market? Well, we graduate about 2 to 3 times each year the numbers of scientists and engineers than there are job openings in the U.S. So the supply is quite in excess by the numbers. It's also, just to briefly through this, if you can follow the chart, these by a couple fields, engineering, well, there aren't enough engineers. In fact, what you find is it's a steady up climb. It goes up and down. It tracks the market. And if I went in detail year by year, what you find is that it's very responsive to market conditions, graduates at the margin, and then more dramatically shown in computer science, which is a trend up, rather steep, and then when the dot-com bust comes, students leave. And I'm not sure what the complaint is. Some people looked at this chart and said, well, you see, they're leaving. And I said, I'm not sure you'd want to hire somebody who wasn't smart enough to figure out the jobs disappeared. But in any event, it's very market responsive is the answer to that. Now, what happened to demand? All right. Now, there are real, I don't want to minimize the employer complaints, the employer difficulties of hiring people. And that is very real. And why does that happen? Well, first, a quote from one employer about the difficulty of finding a population in the United States that's not all above average. That, in fact, if they want to hire people, they might have to hire average people, or sometimes even people below average. I don't know, some might consider that an unrealistic expectation to think that you can only hire everybody above average, unless you're in Lake Wobegon. The other is, if you remember this quote before, where Scott McNeely, his son, said, we want to locate our R&D centers here, and we need the people here. He said that at one point, I think before a Senate testimony. But if you were a worker in the field, you might have heard his other statement to Wall Street, which he said, we're getting out of high-cost geographies. And we do our interviews with scientists, engineers, mid-career and above. They say, it was a great ride. It was a great career. The ride is over. That when you look around, you just this sense of instability. Now, I think as Kevin pointed out, the numbers are small in fact, but people make choices based on perception. And the way this plays out is it doesn't take much to signal a change in perception and how people act. Now, the other is it a extent to which science and engineering in these fields have changed in the perception? If you remember what motivated a kind of a whole generation, 60s, 70s, was the right stuff. And today it might be more better characterized by Dilbert as to what's in the field. So what's been the effect of, I think, all these things together? I said overall the supply has been steady, but there has been a market response, and in some work we're just doing looking at what the changes are in 30 years. In fact, we find, see through here, that when we look at who is staying and who's leaving, and this is we divided up the population to quintiles based on test scores and GPAs, there is a change. The top quintile is leaving in classes and in the workforce, whereas there's a slight increase to make it up in the lower quintiles. And so we also see in the workforce, again, a composition shift. So again, the message here is that there is a market response. And I do find myself as a sociologist in this peculiar position these days, having lifelong skeptic of markets, of being up here arguing that markets do matter and that not all things are irrational. And labor does then for respond to these kinds of things. So it's, again, a brief tour kind of in the weeds of the changes of markets, of responses to organizations and people all coming together to think about what makes a good workplace, both in reality and also in perception and what people respond to. And I'm going to turn over in a minute, I guess, to our HR people, people in a number of firms who have to deal with these perceptions, and I think are in a very difficult position there. On one final note, though, I'll note that current debate and looking forward around healthcare in the U.S. is also, I think, pretending both great benefits in terms of moving healthcare away from the employment relationship, but I would also note is probably likely to provide a greater set of challenges as well for within the firm. The same phenomenon of job lock has been estimated 25% of the workforce when jobs are available would leave, but do not leave because of benefits alone. There, so I will turn over.
Well, there's some really interesting statistics in those first two presentations.